Welcome. Today we're going to talk about sex. We've got an amazing guest, Dr. Tom Murray, who wrote Making Nice with Naughty. And I felt the need to kind of let people know today is not going to be suitable for children. So make sure that you are ready to listen on your own as we talk about sex. And now Dr. Tom Murray is going to join us via Zoom, and I'm really excited to share this with you today. Welcome to the Redhead Reveal Podcast. I am Jen Pinkerton, your Redhead host, a psychotherapist, writer, speaker, the private practice owner of Pinkerton Psychotherapy, and a connection expert. I help people reveal their connectedness within their relationships and sexuality, understanding root causes of beliefs and behaviors that hold them back from success, and assist them to returning to the person that they are born to be before they were limited by trauma, societal or social concerns, or attachment wounds. Redhead Reveal is here to share concerns and questions, provide interviews with thought leaders and friends, and to hold space to discuss life struggles and encourage vulnerability, authenticity, growth, and self-awareness. Welcome, Dr. Tom. So excited to have you today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a joy to be on your show.
Wonderful. You know, I got to tell you, I read the book. This was really amazing, really eye-opening.
I'm so glad you liked it.
Congratulations. Before we dive into that, though, I want to really start off with giving you a chance to tell me about you. Can you tell our audience as well all about your experience and what you do and where your expertise lies?
Well, thank you. Yes, I've been a sex therapist now since 2015. Before that, I was a university counseling center director and did that for a major performing arts conservatory here in the South. And then in 2017, dived into private practice, where now I have two additional clinicians, and we're based in Central North Carolina and primarily just do sex and couples therapy.
I understand that. That is my specialization as well. So I love that, just like you do.
Yeah.
And also, as we were discussing before we got started, you were either on the faculty of where I am going to school right now as a PhD student. So I thought that was kind of fun that we have that commonality.
Yes, the modern sex therapy. So, you know, I've had great experience teaching for a variety of programs, and I think the freedom and flexibility that the Modern Sex Therapy Institute is offering to especially people who are interested in pursuing clinical sexology, you know, there's very few of those options, and so I'm honored to have been affiliated with Modern Sex Therapy Institute.
Absolutely. Well, I want to dive in a little bit. I mean, as I looked at your bio, though, I mean, you gave yourself, you're very modest in what you were saying. But as I was looking, I mean, I think that you're so acclaimed from a presenter from these topics, and you speak so often about it. It's no doubt that you would have put this all in a collective in a book. So, you know, reading that, there was a lot of things that stuck out to me, especially as this is my area, not just from an interviewing standpoint, but from my area of specialization in my own practice as well. Some things that I thought were just really profound. And if you don't mind, I'd love to kind of dive in with that.
Let's do it.
The best quote that stuck out to me, and you're going to be quoted back to yourself, Dr. Tom. You said that people get caught up in the thought that they must be free of discomfort, whatever that is, before they feel confident to take action.
So I
would love for you to expound on that a little bit and how that fits in into this story.
Well, you know, a lot of my patients and couples that I see, they've created this story that in order to take risk in the bedroom or in their relationship, they have to feel comfortable first. And then what that means is they're constantly checking in. Do I feel comfortable yet? Do I feel comfortable yet? Am I free of anxiety? And whenever there's anxiety present, they assume that that means don't progress, don't take a chance, don't take that risk. And of course, you know, everything that we ever really wanted in life is found on the other side of comfort. I mean, you know that as a doctoral student, if you wanted to be comfortable, you would never go to graduate
school. You are correct in that. And that is true, you know, being able to lean into what's difficult and being able to tell, you know, clients to say, you know, we can do hard things.
Yes.
And I think when it comes to sex and it comes to intimacy, there seems to be a stopgap,
a truly moment where the fear and that anxiety is so profound that basically all thought is you know, escapes. There's really nothing else other than that moment. I think it's the anxiety is huge. And I see so many people with those same presenting concerns. And in Making Nice with Naughty, there was so much about that in here that you talked about with case studies and illustrations of couples that might present with maybe what seems as though a mismatched sexual desire, but in fact, it seemed as though it was more about, you know, the terminology that you use about OC, this over-controlled temperament. And yes. So can you define for me and our audience, really, what is this over-controlled temperament and how it relates to sex?
So broadly speaking, the over-controlled temperament is what happens, or it's a descriptor for people who have too much self-control. You know, there's this continuum of over control and under control, and temperaments are just stable ways of showing up in the world, such as introversion, extroversion being two of the most famous temperaments. And those who are over controlled are get a lot of positive feedback by the world out there, because the world loves over-controlled people. We are the ones that get stuff done. And when I say we, I consider myself over-controlled. Anybody who goes to graduate school has to be over-controlled just to get through the right process. But generally speaking, the over-controlled temperament has these four primary characteristics that over-controlled people tend to avoid the unexpected. They resist newness and novelty. They tend to be rather rule-oriented. They pursue perfectionism. They have their ways about them that they like to do the same thing over and over again because they like consistency and certainty. They may experience a struggle with openness of emotion, and may lack kind of awareness about how they are signaling to other people within their relationships. You know, like having a stony face, for example, not being expressive in the face, they may not be aware that that's impeding their relationships. And lastly, they may have underdeveloped interpersonal dynamics, where they struggle being in relationships with others. They, for example, one of the most common complaints that people who are over-controlled have is the sense of loneliness. Mm-hmm. Right. So what I found working with my couples and individuals with their sexual problems, that there was this common theme of sexual perfectionism, mm-hmm. That was getting in their way. And I talk about the four types of sexual perfectionism: the I have to be sexually perfect, my partner has to be sexually perfect, I think my partner thinks I have to be sexually perfect, and the last one is society expects me to be sexually perfect. And so when those are present, they can certainly have a deleterious effect on people's sexual and intimate relationships.
And what a burden that is to really bring into the bedroom.
Oh my gosh, for mm-hmm. sure, for sure. And how that burden then is communicated to their partner. Mm-hmm. Right. So this feeling of I have to have things a certain way in order to be able to be with someone that I purport to love creates just another barrier to intimacy.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned perfectionism, and I've often viewed perfectionism as a quest for emotional safety, almost a need to control the environment to feel safe. And I wonder, do you see a lot of attachment wounds that are showing up in this way? Do you see a lot of that contributing factors of feeling maybe a lack of emotional attunement that creates that? Is there that connection for you with this type?
Yeah, you know, certainly can. I wouldn't say there's a specific attachment style mm-hmm. that correlates with over control. In part, there are two subtypes of over-controlled people that I I really regret that I didn't dive into the book.
Well, you can now.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
The one subtype is the overly disagreeable subtype.
Mm-hmm.
And then the overly agreeable. So the overly disagreeables are the people that need to be right.
Mm.
And so they are more likely to have the avoidant attachment style,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. And then the overly agreeable is the need to be liked.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are more likely to have the anxious attachment style. By the way, this is my conjecture. There's not been literature to correlate these things. It's just my clinical observation. And so how that shows up in relationship relative to attachment style, I think is pertinent. So what's underneath that, though, to underscore your point, is that the thing that over-controlled people fear the most is uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if I'm overly disagreeable, I create certainty by pushing people away.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. And mm-hmm. then the overly agreeable may create certainty by saying, I want to know where you are at every given moment, so I don't have to worry about the mystery side.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. So there's just different ways of handling it.
So, you know, the mismatched sexual desire point that I made a moment ago, I feel like that's what a lot of couples present when they come to seek therapy, because they don't really understand. All they know is that I want something and this person wants something different, and there's a big gap, there's a disconnect. And there is really a lack of that psychoeducation to understand what that is. So when people come to see you and the basis for you writing this book, where all do you see that going? You know, is it often that we're mismatched, they think, and then they learn that this is the point of it? Or do you see other presenting concerns that still ends up getting to be, you know, what the answer is really this? I'm wondering, what other paths do people take to this, you know, knowledge that now they recognize, okay, this is really the stumbling block. This is the boulder that's in the bedroom with us, basically.
Yeah, well, you know, the psychoeducation is the bulk of the work that I do. Particularly being in the South, a lot of people who've grown up in families or communities where sex education was pretty Spartan, that talking about how there are the different types of desire, you know, our colleague Emily Nagoski, you know, dives into that in Come As You Are, and underscoring that for people to help them to see that spontaneous desire isn't the only one, nor is it the right one to have, but that any whatever one's sexual desire type is the right and perfect type for them. And so that can be really helpful to break down for couples, so that they're not unnecessarily pathologizing the other person's desire and then fueling or criticizing one another, and that then leading to the toxicity within their relationship. So psychoeducation is a real important aspect of the work that we do. And then certainly there are it's multifactorial in terms of what it contributes to people's challenges relative to their reconnection. You know, mm-hmm. one of the big ones that couples will say is, I just feel like I don't know this person anymore, right? And I remind them that there was a time that they didn't know them.
Yes.
And they still fell in love.
Right. Dating time, what changed, right?
That's right. So just the evidence of the sense of mystery, they think that that's the problem, when in fact, that's the solution.
Right.
Right. And privileging the not knowing, the rediscovery, not buying into the illusion that you can know your partner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talk about that in the book in terms of the differences between intimacy and closeness. You know, mm-hmm. that illusion that I can know my partner. You can't know your partner. There's just no way. The most you will ever know is the story your mind tells you about your partner.
Yes, exactly. And in that, when you're talking about that, I remember you gave these building blocks in the book, and one of them was about establishing connection and that having that connection is going to get you to that level of intimacy you seek. We talk a lot about connection on this podcast because I really feel like it's the crux of so very many things. And it's what a lot of people are missing and they don't recognize what that is. But in sexuality terms, to have that sex life where you feel like we're thriving, you know, you've got to have that level of connection. And I think having an understanding of where that plays into that and how to achieve it, you know, with that authenticity, with the vulnerability to get to that, basically the building block of achieving some great levels of intimacy and sex. It's I think something that is the missing link often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you referenced in Come As You Are, the differences between that spontaneous or the responsive. I've often found that clients will come and they don't understand the difference between the two of them. And when they do start to learn about responsive desire, it's almost as though, oh, now we have something that's not about us. It's not that I'm wrong. It's not that I'm yes. inferior in the bedroom. It's not that I don't know what I'm doing. It's just simply we're wired differently, and that's okay.
Yes. Oh, for
we
sure.
We can be different and have an amazing sex life once we understand each other. I feel like it's also no different than a fundamental idea that we kind of have to give love in a way that our partner will receive it. And if you understand how they receive it and what those messages are about sex and what the story in their head is as well, I think that makes a really big difference. And you dive into that contextual desire a little bit in the book too, talking about that. Can you tell me a little bit more about the contextual piece of that?
Yeah, it's this awareness that we have brakes and accelerators. And so some of us have, it's also called the dual response model. You know, some of us have certain elements in our lives that fuel our sexual desire. And then there may be things that impede our sexual desire. So for example, a stress. For mm-hmm. some people, if they have a little bit of stress in their life, they are totally not interested in sex. While right. others say, you know, sex is a wonderful stress reliever. Bring it on, right? Body odor, for example. Some people get turned on when their partner comes back from the gym. Other people are like, you know, I want to be clean.
That's
I want you to be clean. Yeah,
yes, that's right. Exactly.
So, understanding what your partner's brakes and accelerators are, so that you know. To not contribute to the breaks and you know what you can do to accentuate the accelerators, but also that personal knowledge of what are my breaks, what are my accelerators, and am I doing what is necessary in order to minimize those breaks and accentuate those accelerators?
You said it perfectly. You know, you had a case study about a couple that I can't remember their names in the book, but it was a couple where she wanted to have sex on Saturdays. She knew that Saturdays were going to be the night they had sex. She could plan her life around that. That gave her that feeling of control and safety. And this is when it was going to happen.
That's right.
The problem was in the book, you illustrated how, what if by then she doesn't have any desire? She's too tired to enjoy it. And so all these opportunities to have sex throughout the week were missed. And then she ends up not feeling satisfied sexually. And obviously her partner recognizes the disconnect there. Can you expand a little bit about that type of presenting client and what
yes.
that means in relation to the book?
Yeah. So like you mentioned, over-controlled people love certainty. They love predictability. They love to schedule things often and know that, okay, this is on the schedule. They then are less likely to entertain their own bodily sensations. So they may even during the middle of the week be desirous, but they're like, oh, I'm not going to give into that. I know that we're going to do it on Saturday because there are these other things that need my attention. And so I'm going to do that. And to me, that kind a hoarding of time, which is often one of the things that over-controlled people do. They tend to be hoarders of one thing or then another. And for over-controlled people, time can often be something that they try to hoard. Mm-hmm. Got to save time, can't waste time, that kind of thing. And so they put it on the calendar because the sense of duty, I have to do this, it's important, but then often negate their own drive and postpone it. And even when, if they were to allow themselves to let loose, they would actually have a much better sexual experience.
I understand. I agree with that completely. I think I've seen a lot of couples who come to seek sex therapy, couples counseling, either with the idea of, it seems so structured, it's no longer any fun.
Oh, that's right. Right. It's like how I talk about the intimacy versus closeness. I describe that in the book, where a lot of couples will come in and they'll say, we're not close anymore. Mm. And then when I spend 20 minutes with them, I'm realizing, oh, they're actually too close. Mm-hmm. They have too much closeness. Where I define closeness as low risk, low anxiety, high predictability, comfort, and familiarity. They've really privileged those things. Versus intimacy is high risk, high anxiety, low predictability, newness, novelty.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
And that's anxiety inducing. There's an element of mystery, and people shy away from that. And then at the extreme, you just have that old couple sitting at the diner for lunch and not a word's exchanged between them. Right. All that they have is an unspoken contract to die together.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's like the view that you can get when you're watching a couple in a restaurant, and the ones that are talking and they're connected and they're animated, they'll add it, oh, they're dating. But we want to get away from that. We want to be in relationships that thrive. We want to be in relationships where we have this ultimate connection, both in the bedroom and outside the bedroom. And with that type of client that comes to you, and they're stating that they're too close. They say that it's just kind of dead. They're great roommates. They're great business partners, the business of being married, but they don't have that passion. How do you prescribe for them that solution when it is the exact situation that you just gave me? What would you prescribe with that? How do you get them to a level of understanding of what they need to do to shake things up?
Well, I'm first very curious, what are the rules that they tell themselves have to be in place in order for them to let loose? And then we actually question what those, the validity of those rules, right? And are they willing to be a little uncomfortable, a little awkward? If they have zero willingness to be awkward, it really doesn't bode well for the longevity of the relationship, because it's when Pema Chodron, a Buddhist nun, says, when you lean into anxiety, you're just that closer to the truth, right? And so reframing for couples what it means to be willing to be a little anxious, a little awkward as that pursuit of something new. So for example, I'll often ask couples, what percentage of the time when you have sex, is it in the bedroom? And a lot of the couples say, oh, it's all the time. Well, stop having sex only in the bedroom. You know, your mortgage is for the entire house.
That's right.
You can enjoy the entire house, right?
Yeah.
Or I give an example in the book about someone coming up behind their partner in front of the window. And the partner gets really anxious of, what if people could see us? And of course, that wasn't possible. It was dark inside and light outside. So the likelihood of someone seeing was just, but that was too activating, too anxiety provoking.
Yeah,
right?
It overrode any possible ability to have pleasure from that, because it overrode everything.
Yeah. So some people do need they need in place certain elements that help them to feel safe and secure. So I give the metaphor of the fire of desire, and these stones around the fire are really the things that we need in order to feel safe and secure. But one also has to come to the relationship having seen themselves as sexual beings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, becoming parents, for example, for a lot of people, their sexual identity begins to erode over time because they've adopted a different identity, mom or dad, and that just isn't sexy. You know, I think Esther Perel says
problem.
Right.
Yeah,
I think Esther Perel says, no one wants to have sex with someone's mom.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you touched on these concepts of basically what I drill down to thinking, it's about being willing to be seen.
Yeah.
And that correlates with so much when it comes to, I think, healing from anything, you know, being willing to be seen. And so a lot of couples that come to seek help because they just don't have a great sex life, so much of that relates to, are you comfortable being seen? Can you take the risk? Can you be willing to, for the fear of maybe I'm not going to be viewed the way I want to be viewed? Maybe it's not going to go well, but do you take the risk? Can you have that connection with your partner to do that, knowing that on the other side, you know, that discomfort's temporary? Because on the other side, imagine how great it would be to have this amazing sex life with your partner. And I think that it's so profound of a thought, but yet a lot of people miss that.
Right. I'm thinking of a couple that I saw a few weeks ago where a new couple, the husband has had a history of erectile dysfunction and rapid ejaculation. And they've been together for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. The wife said, you know, all of a sudden he whips out this strap-on dildo and he puts it on and it was some of the best sex. And he leans into me and he goes, I read that in your book. And that takes a lot of risk. Right. Particularly yes. For men, to the very notion of wearing a strap-on dildo when as a substitute, if you will, for an erect penis so that you can still have fun. For some people, they immediately go to, oh, that's emasculating. I could never do that. But when you think about sex as really the pursuit of pleasure, then you're seeing that, oh, there's so many ways in which we can have a good time. But when you have a performance-based view of sex, then it's like, oh, sex is only good if it looks like this, mm-hmm. right? And now we're rule oriented and rigid versus mm-hmm. pleasure based, which is, you know, hey, if I'm wearing a strap on dildo and I'm pleasing my partner, I can derive pleasure out of seeing that pleasure.
Yes. And on that note, it makes me think of that inheritance that is passed down to us sometimes of what's appropriate. What have we inherited? What were the generational trauma or the ideas, just even belief systems, not necessarily traumatic, but just inherent ideas that were modeled or we inferred that this is the way we're supposed to be. And can we do something different? Can we recognize that we can throw all those rules out of the window? Can we take risk? And you mentioned, you know, even something as what to some would think so elementary, toys in the bedroom, toys using in sex. But some people feel like that means we're less than. It really attacks that feeling of, I don't belong here. I'm not worthy. I'm not doing a good job. I'm not enough. And I think tapping into I'm not enough, then we've opened up, you know, a big can of worms here with how people feel.
To add to that, a lube, mm-hmm. right? Some people think, oh, if I have to use lube, you know, or if my partner has to use lube, that there's something, that's evidence of something wrong. When in fact, I think that's evidence of something right, in that you have the kind of relationship where you want to maximize pleasure. And if that means reaching over to the bedside table and getting a pump of lube because that would help to make enjoying sex easier, it's a sign of something right.
Absolutely. You know, it should be this idea that anything goes. This is about us. This is about these two people in that moment, or even if it's not that type of relationship, three people, whatever works. But in that context, it's about whatever's going to make everybody feel good. It's consensual, and then it can be amazing. And when it comes to you know, what you're saying too, sometimes lube is one of the things that's needed just from a standpoint. If you're looking at a biology standpoint, you know, there's some women that come and they see sex as painful. And so they just stop having sex. Right. When you know what? If you can be seen and you can communicate and you can be vulnerable with your partner and say, hey, it just doesn't feel good. I didn't want to tell you, so I've just avoided sex. But you know, if we would maybe use lube, it could feel a heck of a lot better. That changes things fundamentally. And I think it's often something I see, this unfortunate lack of communication. And it's not just talking, it's being taking the risk in what you're saying.
Mm, mm. Yeah, that vulnerability, which from an over-controlled, again, you know, over-controlled people, vulnerability is really tough.
Scary.
Scary, you know. Mm-hmm. It's the antithesis of the certainty, mm-hmm. right?
That they rely on.
What was that?
That they've come to rely on, right?
That's right.
And it's in every part of their life. For the over-controlled person, that sex is one part of where that control is showing up. It's showing up in all these things.
Oh,
and
yes.
So it's so certain in every part of their life. How could we leave that behind here? Because we need it and use it in so many other ways. And as your book points out, there's nothing negative about being that over-controlled person. There's a lot of amazing strengths in being
that's right.
You know, right. It's one of the things that make us unique. Everybody's different. Every brings their own stuff to the table. And it's learning, okay, but maybe can we leave that behind and not put it on the table just while we're having sex, you know?
Yeah. I think that is really what was important about the book, was to highlight that OC comes with a lot of virtues.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is going to become a problem, where does it show up as a problem? I tend to find it showing up in people's sex and intimate relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I give the example of, the stereotypical over-controlled person goes behind their partner to rearrange the dishwasher because it wasn't, quote, done right. Right. And so you think, oh, I'm just going to do it because I want to make sure the dishes are clean. Well, that may be true, but the partner perceives it as a form of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Back to I'm not enough. I'm not doing it right. I'm not enough.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so that's the dynamic that you often see, where you have a partner who is more over-controlled than the other.
Mm-hmm.
I very rarely see over-controlled people with under-controlled people. It's usually one person's over-controlled and the other is less over-controlled.
Mm-hmm.
But the more over-controlled person assumes that the other must be under-controlled, when in fact they're just less over-controlled.
Right.
But then, you know, you get somewhat of almost a pissing contest, where they can be somewhat competitive too with each other. And you know, to be in a relationship where you feel like you're on opposing teams isn't very erotic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of a libido killer if you think about it.
yes,
right.
For sure.
You know, in the book also, Making Nice with Naughty, you mentioned that you have a self-test in there. You talked about your introduction, and I saw it in chapter one. I love that when someone reads this book, if this is resonating, if it's sounding familiar, if they're recognizing some of the traits, they have the ability to kind of check that out without really maybe being ready to go seek help on it. They can kind of look at that differently. And your book prescribes this way, I think, to view it so differently, in such a way that, again, doesn't pathologize, and it just educates and opens a door for a very different experience sexually.
Yeah, well, you know, I wish I was more familiar with this concept years ago. I was in a long-term relationship and went to see a psychologist. And it was like the second session, first session. And I said to the psychologist, you know, I've come to realize I don't exude much of a sexuality. And she says, Tom, you're right, you don't. And I think that I was so intensely over-controlled up until that point. I'm still over-controlled. There's not enough drugs or therapy in the world that will make that different. But, you know, being able to turn down the volume on my over-controlledness so that I can experience the joy and aliveness of life that so many of our under-controlled people just take naturally.
Right. Right. It's kind of just something they take for granted because they don't recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Where they would be absolutely caged by the rules and structure that so many over-controlled people require.
Mm-hmm. Do you see, you mentioned that you don't often see the opposites, but I can't help but think there must be a little bit of yin and yang in that to some degree, you know, that sometimes we are attracted to someone who's a little more free-spirited than we are. And that you know, that free-spirited person, that I can use that label, is also maybe more attracted to someone that's a little more structured, because we're each giving each other something we don't have.
Yeah, I think that that's certainly true, even within my own relationship, there's a style with my partner where there's much more emotional expressiveness, a much more variation of emotion. And like a very typical OC person, you know, I can, I'm the kind of person that if you saw me out in the world and you asked me how I was doing, one of my favorite F words is fine, which is very common among other over-controlled people. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, we tend to have a limited range of emotions, but then there are times when we have emotional leakage, right? Where we might get, you know, incredibly excited or maybe even angry, and we leak it out a little bit but usually that happens only within a very close knit group of people.
I understand. You know, this is so, I think your book really hits on something that's so profound. And I really hope that a lot of people will take the time to kind of think about this, to kind of look at themselves in the mirror and really recognize, you know, what do we want out of our sex life? What are we missing? And could this be something that really pertains to me? And yeah. You positioned the book and wrote it in the way that I felt like as I was reading it, are you talking to me? And that's when you know you've hit something, you know you've gotten there. Well, to recap, you know, Dr. Tom Murray, the author of Making Nice with Naughty, it's just so great to have you here today. I want to kind of mention where everybody can find you. You know, obviously your book is available on, you know, all of the major booksellers online.
That's right.
And your Instagram and your socials, I always like to give a shout out to that. Yours is Dr. Tom Murray for Instagram. Doctor, that's all together. And then Dr. Tom Murray, Dr. period, Tom period Murray on Facebook and YouTube, real Dr. Tom Murray. That's awesome. So I want to make sure that people can find you, can learn more about you, and can really, man, read this book, get this book.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show and availing me to your listeners. It was a great opportunity.
It's really been educational for me and a lot of fun, and I can't wait to see what you do next. So we'll have to stay in touch.
Indeed.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Tom Murray. And we'll
bye-bye.
Be talking soon. All right. Bye-bye. Thank you all for listening today. And I'm signing off. Best and rest.
You can find out more information about me and about the Redhead Reveal podcast on our website at PinkertonPsychotherapy.com.